That's an interesting point. Bob Whitlam himself owns such a strong personality. How did he get along with these two, or whether it was perhaps because they were rather quiet and more they could survive with one another?
Well, I guess they were counter foils for each other in a way. I mean, I guess in all these sort of situations, the strong personality, especially when he's the reason that all of us are there, gets his way pretty much most of the time. So yeah, we did have to bend to the rules or the ruler. I guess though that if there was an issue, and I know occasionally and just on our part, if there was an issue you felt very strongly about and you talk back to him, you could sometimes prevail. I don't know. I mean, I wasn't privy to any disputes between Whitlam and those men, or any others really. But no, I think it was respectful on both directions. Mm.
There are a couple of other people mentioned in there as well. Dick Hall.
Dick Hall. Now, Dick. Yes, Dick Hall came. He was a journalist. A Sydney knockabout journalist who came to Whitlam's office from. Now, Peter Cullen moved on. I don't know. Well, I think Peter went out into the lobbying world. I don't know exactly how or why that happened, but Dick Hall came in and took over that position, maybe in 68. I don't exactly know. He's died since too. He was a little round. Terribly well-read, but scruffy-looking. I always remember he had grubby fingernails. Very well-read. And he was involved in policy things. Well, I suppose Peter Cullen was more a party insider. And Dick Hall, having come from a journalistic background, had networks outside and was involved in almost... talking policy to people outside the party, or I think that was his bit more of his role. I think roles just developed as people's skills or aptitudes came to bear, and there were no duty statements. It was much more you just did whatever needed to be done in the office. I suppose there were, and Jim Spiegelman was another person who worked in opposition. Jim came from Sydney. Well, he's Chief Justice of New South Wales now. He'd worked as a solicitor, or I suppose a barrister, but I don't think he was old enough to be a barrister. But he'd been involved in political activity as a student, and he came into the office after Race Matthews moved on to stand for election for Casey in 69. So sometime in 69, I imagine, Race moved out in order to campaign, and Jim came into the position of senior private secretary.
How were they to work? I mean, you in that short period of time, just over a year, a bit more than that, you worked with at least three different secretaries.
It was a very easygoing office. Everybody, it was, as I said before, it was fairly democratic. No, there was not really any hierarchy, except that the senior private secretary, I suppose, if it came to a crunch, probably had more say-so or more the ear of the boss than others. But it didn't ever come to that. We just all, we're all doing... It was a very good team, and as you say, the membership of it changed a bit, but we were all sort of there for Whitlam, and no friction that I remember. I mean, occasionally I suppose we would get tired of these boys being down in the bar more often than we thought was fair, but I mean, we were only girls. One of my funniest memories, though, of the very early days in my very early days in the job was somebody said to me, I don't know who it was now, look, get this statement out to all senators and members. So I diligently photocopied it and whatever we did, probably ran it off on a Xerox, And I started to whip it around to all senators, members, Liberal, Country Party, Labor, the lot. And they, and I don't know how far I got down this track, but somebody said to me, no, when we say all senators and members, it doesn't mean all senators and members, it means all Labor senators and members. So whether I had to go and retrieve, I don't remember going back and retrieving anything from the government side of things, but I got very close to delivering them. Just, you know, people take for granted understandings, which sometimes take a while to develop.
Yes, did you find that transition, perhaps from private enterprise and from public service into this political hotbed of activity, did you find that hard at all?
I wouldn't say it was hard. It was very interesting. I think you had to keep your eyes and ears open and your mouth shut, and just. Often, I mean, we didn't know what was going on around us. There were issues, big issues running, and we wouldn't have known quite what was happening. Sometimes you would know, sometimes you wouldn't know. But the trenches, the sort of work I was doing, no. I mean, I was, I'm pretty adaptable, and I think I soon learned that something had to be done. You had to find a way of doing it, and we weren't climbing Everest or anything, or doing anything that was physically impossible or... it was just a matter of finding a way of getting something done. You had to be pretty flexible, though.
Hmm. Well, that brings me to the next point. A typical day in your job, what would that be like?
Well, I suppose it depends whether the house was sitting or not. When the house was sitting, oh dear, we used to burn the candle at both ends. We'd start at 9, usually at 9. They'd always, Whitlam was always up on his feet making speeches when he was leader of the opposition, and so there were always speeches being typed and retyped. This is before word processors. And sometimes we'd even get to the stage where pages were going into the chamber as they came off the typewriter. He probably had a previous draft with him, which he might have had handwritten changes to, which was a fallback, but no, we were sort of sailing pretty close to the wind in terms of time pressures often. And then if there was a press briefing, I'd take note of that. I typed up the transcripts of those. I don't know that I did unless there was a problem. I had notes against which we could check something if something needed to be checked. I don't think I automatically typed them up. And then we'd grab a bite of lunch, and then question time was always the busy time. That was usually pretty, we listened rather than did anything much during question time, and we sometimes used to go into that little curtained alcove off the chamber where we could stand, not for too long, but have a listen if something interesting was going on. And then afternoons were probably more of the same, a lot of typing letters, speeches. There was always work to be done. There was always, we didn't sit around reading novels or chatting. It was pretty busy.
You said you actually, during question time, you were there listening. Did you actually, so you went to the public galleries or?
No. We didn't actually go into the chamber, and we wouldn't have done it very often, but if it was a fiery question time, you sometimes might just dash across the corridor for a bit of a look. There was a curtained alcove off the corridor, which is as far as we ever went. We were girls. The boys could go into the advisors' seats, but no, we didn't ever go into the chamber proper.
You mentioned lunch. Where would you take lunch?
We would dash down to what we used to call the sheltered workshop, the staff dining room. And usually it was a pretty quick lunch. We didn't linger. We just grabbed something to eat, I guess, and back to the desk. In the evenings, we had a longer break, and we often used to eat over at the lobby, especially, well, we were earning good money and we didn't have time to shop. So you could spend money on a dinner at the lobby because it was about the only time you spent money. Work was all-consuming and you didn't have the time or the energy to go spending your money on other things. So a meal at the lobby was a nice break away from the place in a way, and it was And then we'd come back at 8 o'clock and we'd work till midnight, and then we'd go to a party.
When you say we, who is that? The girls?
Probably the girls from the office, yes. Mm. And Barbara and I particularly. I think Irina didn't work quite as long hours as we did. I don't know why that was. She probably was there when the house was sitting, but Barbara and I particularly would work long into the night, because my job involving Graham was inevitably a nocturnal sort of, and Barbara's a bit of a night owl herself, so I think that's probably the cause of the... And when the house was sitting, we just were there, and the house in those days used to sit until whenever. But then when it got up, we'd go off to a party.
So did you at all mix during the sort of normal working day with people from other sections or other parts of Old Parliament?
Oh, yes. We were all... I think that's the biggest... Well, I'm not working in Parliament House now, but I think it's true to say that the biggest difference between working in this building, the Old Parliament House, and working today in New Parliament House is that we were all friends. We used to go to each other's parties. We used to go out on dates with people from other parties. We used to go to parties in Billy Snedden's office, play cricket. He had a cricket wicket taped on the glass door onto the corridor, and we used a paper ball and had a bat. And I mean, everybody mingled really. There were no intensities of political hatred or anything like that. We just were all in this, maybe it was the age we were or the stage we were, but it was very good-natured, and there were a few people we didn't fancy particularly, but...
But you had contact during work, in a sense?
Probably during working hours, we were all a bit too busy to be socialising, but come the sunset, people used to drop around to other people's offices with a beer and sit and have a drink. So it was a bit more relaxed after dinner. You often were there because the house was sitting. The phones wouldn't be ringing the way they would in the daytime. So it was a bit more... there was a bit more social life in the evenings. But certainly, yeah, people would drop into each other's offices.
Each other's offices, would you drop into, say, the offices of a Liberal member or...
I think there was more of them visited us for whatever reason. I don't know whether that we were... No, I probably wouldn't have left my desk. I think I was a bit too diligent.
So you'd have to say that the working conditions here definitely affected, had a significant impact on your social life.
Oh, yes, yeah. I mean, you didn't have time for a real social life, because by the time, especially in sitting weeks, by the time you got home on a Friday night, and at that stage I was still living with my parents in Yarralumla, and I was so tired on a Friday night after a sitting week, I couldn't talk to anybody. But fortunately there was this television show on called A Family at War, and I remember it was a lifesaver for me, because I used to get home, I'd say, I can't talk, I have to watch this. And then I'd watch it and then I'd toddle off to bed. And so I avoided unpleasantness, but it was just... And then I'd sleep. If I didn't force myself not to, I would have probably slept for half the weekend. And then, of course, you never saw any of your friends. So I had to sort of make a point of not spending all weekend sleeping, but trying to catch up with the few friends I did have outside of Parliament.
Yes, and I was going to ask you. Did you manage to actually have and hold on to friends?
Yeah, I did. I did. Yes, there was a little gang of friends that I'd known before I worked in Parliament House, and we kept going through those years. But as I say, it was you had to make an effort to keep the contacts alive. Friendships die very quickly if you don't put something into them.
So the working conditions here, how would you describe them from an employee point of view?
Well, from looking at it from today's perspective, goodness, smoking. Graham's office used to be called by the cleaners the big ashtray. I mean, we all smoked though. I used to smoke. I used to smoke, particularly when we moved in around the corner here into the PM's office. When my phone rang, I'd light up a cigarette, and then I'd have that in the ashtray. The phone would ring again, I'd light up another cigarette. Sometimes I'd have two going at once. It was just habit. But, I mean, it was... we all smoked in those days. So there was all this polluted air, which we helped to pollute, we had, as I say, no space other than your desk space, no privacy, no panels between people so that you couldn't hear what other people were saying. It was all open, real open plan. And yes, if anybody was shouting, everybody heard. Working conditions, well, I mean, there were no complaints, really. I mean, it was just probably the physicality of the place that was, particularly when, after 1972, when we moved around into the refurbished PM's office, and the office I had there was about half this, about, it was just like a horse stable, me at one end and a girl who helped me at the other end. That was bad working conditions. No natural light, no...
We might take a walk around and have a look at that.
Yeah.
The you mentioned the in very, very long hours you worked. Was there a regular arrangement for payment of overtime?
We just used to fill in our overtime claim forms with a record of the hours we'd worked and we got paid. The magical department did all that. We there was no limit. The Commonwealth drivers, I don't think it applied to us, but it applied to the Commonwealth drivers, and it applied to the press people who were press secretaries on the AJA award. If they didn't get an 8-hour break, they got double pay for the hours they worked after the shortish break. But we didn't have any of that. We often finished work at, well, midnight and were back on deck before that, particularly when we were travelling or during a campaign or something. But anyway, that wasn't relevant to us. We got paid for whatever hours we worked.
Mm. So what were you actually classified as? What's your substantive classification?
I think it was just a stenographer classification. I don't think there were grades of stenographer. I think we were all on the same basic. We girls were all on the same basic pay. I've never thought about it.
But the overtime, in a sense, was the difference between, you know, having a job and having a well paid job.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I know that there was an article in the Sydney afternoon paper, which doesn't exist anymore, the Sydney Sun, and it was a story about, I think, Barbara and Lorraine and me, and it was headed Poor Little Rich Girls, and it talked about how we worked so hard we didn't have time to spend our salaries. It must have been 1969, before the election in 69, they did a feature on the Whitlam staffers, but that's what it was headed, Poor Little Rich Girls. I mean, I don't think any of us were rich. We just probably didn't earn a lot of money, but we earned more money than we could spend.
And you didn't have the time to spend it.
Didn't have the time to spend it either.
Now, that you mentioned this was, of course, sitting weeks are different to non-sitting periods. How did that impact on your workload?
It greatly, non-sitting weeks, you could catch up with all the filing, all the things you hadn't done during the busy sitting weeks, have a long lunch occasionally, come in a little late, go home a little early. Yes, it did make a big difference. It was perhaps not always the difference between a sitting week and a non-sitting week. It also had to do with whether Mr. Whitlam was in town. If he was in town, we'd be busy. But if he wasn't, if he was travelling or back in Sydney and not in the office, life was quieter and at a more gentle pace.
What parts of the building did you use regularly and which did you sort of hardly ever set foot in?
King's Hall was obviously part of the thoroughfare. We never went down the... I don't think I ever went down the government corridor. We always cut across King's Hall to the opposition corridor. And this is obviously up till 72. The Parliamentary Library, we were in there a lot because being in opposition, we relied on the Legislative Research Service, or the library as it was then called, for a lot of research work. So we're in and out of there with requests or collecting things or asking for whatever we'd been told to ask for. The We didn't ever really go to the non-members bar. We might have occasionally stopped by there. I don't remember that particularly. The dining room, we would have lunch and occasional dinners in. The speaker's office, we used to have to be in and out of to get passes for people when they were visiting to sit in and listen. Occasionally went up to the press gallery with press, put things in the boxes, and ring the bell. But the chamber, no, except as I mentioned, we hang about in the vestibule, that little, I don't know if that's the right word for it, that curtained area, alcove, I suppose is better. I just remember one really dramatic evening in the reps when it was St. John was getting stuck into John Gorton, and the drama of that was palpable. I mean, I can. It's really 40 years later that really sticks in my mind still as a sort of a almost too much tension. And I remember being in that little curtained alcove when that was sort of happening. We couldn't believe that this man was saying about his leader what he was saying.
You mentioned, I was quite surprised to hear that you hardly ever went down to saw or used the non-members bar. Yet your colleagues were obviously to be found down there.
Well, it was sort of a bloke's place, and they used to tell each other their stories, and I think that probably we would have been pounced upon and... I don't know... I'm only speaking for myself. I don't know whether Barbara spent time down there, but it wasn't really anything I wanted to do. And as I say, I was a bit diligent. I was a bit inclined to be at my post or not there at all.
Coming back to an issue which we touched on briefly, sort of equipment you used in the office, did it change over the time that you were there?
Oh, it did. It certainly did. Well, as we talked about typewriters, and the other marked change in technology, I suppose, was how we used to reproduce speeches. I remember when we first started off, we used to have to cut stencils. I don't know whether you remember them, but they were this sort of waxy sort of paper, and you hit it with your typewriter, and if you made a mistake, you had to fill it up with pink liquid stuff and let that dry and then have another go. And then that went onto a press and off Gestetners, I think they were called. That was the first method I remember. And then there came some things which I think were called multiliths or something. It was a sort of like a cardboard that you used to type on, and you had a special rubber that you could, if you made a mistake, you could erase the error and correct it. And that got, I suppose, similarly put onto a plate of some sort, inked up. I don't think we had photocopiers. And then I remember the wretched fax machines came in, and particularly in government, we got very annoyed with these things because they used to be able to get at us and send. Canberra used to be, when we were away somewhere, Canberra used to be able to send work up to us when we were travelling, concentrating on something or other else. And so at one stage, I think we quite deliberately sabotaged the thing. We pulled the paper tray out so that we couldn't get any more paperwork from Canberra. But that's, you know, that was no mobile phones, no... I remember seeing somebody during an election campaign with some sort of a phone in the boot of their car. And then I heard about this amazing thing where somebody plugged their... then computers, I suppose, plugged their computer into the wall and sent their story off to their newspaper by just plugging their computer into the wall. So we've seen so many technological changes.
Did you actually get any form of word processing by the time you left?
Where would we have been at in 75? I left in April 75. We might have had typewriters with... a 10-word memory or something like that, but I don't think it was any more sophisticated than that. It certainly wasn't computers. That came later. But I can't be sure about that, whether up in April 75 we were still on golf balls or whether we had these little 10-word memory things.
What would you, or how would you describe your relationship with your colleagues in the office?
Oh, very, it was very egalitarian and friendly. I don't think, we didn't have very many crosswords. I did have one episode with Graham where I shouted at him, but which he's never forgotten, but he was being naughty and I just got cross. But generally, no, it was a pretty happy place to work. We all, I guess in a way too, we had to combine against this strong man we worked for at times when if he was in a bad mood, it's fairly well known that he had occasional bad moods. We just sort of warn each other and keep out of his way or stand up to him if we felt that had to happen. But no, it was a pretty collegiate team. It wasn't, I don't remember ill feelings. I think occasionally you might be a little bit of a frisson of something, but it all blew over. I really honestly don't remember any major difficulties with anybody.
Did you intend to have anyone who actually you could would regard as your supervisor?
E.G. Whitlam. No. I mean, Graham, I would, because I was employed to work for Graham, if he asked me to do something, I would obviously do it. If he told me to do something I didn't want to do, I probably still would have done it. But no, I didn't have we didn't have that sort of, there wasn't anybody you could go to. Well, sorry, I could have gone to the senior private secretary if I'd had a problem with, say, Graham asking me to work extraordinary hours that I didn't think were reasonable, and I'd wanted to pursue that, I probably would have gone to the senior private secretary. That's the sort of... He would have been the supervisor in default, I suppose, but I don't think it came to that.
Mm.